You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What you're about to hear is a conversation with New Yorker staff writer and Harvard Literature professor Louis Menand, the author and Baffler magazine editor John Summers, and the longtime scholar and critic Daniel Aaron. The subject is Mass Cult and Mid Cult, Essays Against the American Grain by Dwight MacDonald, recently published by New York Review Books Classics. Louis Menand wrote the introduction to the book, and he's up first.
Okay. Hi. Thank you very much. It's nice to be here to talk about Dwight MacDonald and this collection, which is being published by New York Review Books, which, as you know, has a tremendous series with hundreds of titles now of reprints of classics that have been unavailable and collections like this one. This is a project that John Summers really put together with the New York Review editors, and I was asked to write the introduction to it. The collection that John edits is made up mostly of pieces by Dwight MacDonald that were published in a book called Against the American Grain, which came out in 1962, published by Random House. And there are a few pieces that were published somewhat later, these pieces being an attack on Tom Wolfe and the New Journalism, which we may have an opportunity to talk about. Against the American Grain was the best-selling of MacDonald's books. He was not really a book writer. He struggled to put together this particular book, and it actually began under contract with Random House. The editor was Jason Epstein, to write a book on popular culture, and in the end, he decided to collect pieces that he had already published. But the book was very popular in its time, and it's fascinating to read it now, both because of the quality of the literary journalism, of which MacDonald was a master, and also because it takes us back to a time before the 60s and allows us to revisit a lot of the issues that were important in intellectual culture then. I'm just going to say a few words about the road MacDonald took to get to 1962 and Against the American Grain. We're very pleased to have Professor Dan Aaron here, who knew MacDonald and has agreed to say a few words about him. And then John will talk about some of the larger issues that are raised by MacDonald's journalism. So MacDonald was born on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. His family was reasonably well off, though not wealthy. He attended a number of private schools and ended up at Yale, which is a college in Southern Connecticut. He at Yale was a literary figure, something of a dandy, something of a snob, and he, when he left Yale, went to work at, of all places, Macy's department store. He had a kind of romantic idea about business, of which he was quickly disabused. He quit Macy's after less than a year and went to work for Time magazine, which had been started up by Henry Luce in 1923. And then he moved on from Time to Fortune, where he spent most of his time with the Luce organization. When he joined Fortune, MacDonald doesn't seem to have had any particular political views or politics. But that changed in the 1930s as he was writing for Fortune and began covering the business world. This, of course, is after the crash and during the Great Depression. Interestingly, Fortune magazine, a magazine devoted to business, was started in 1930, about 3 months after the Wall Street crash. Not a very propitious time to start a magazine about business. He also married a woman named Nancy Rodman, who did have politics, left-wing politics, and she introduced him to Marx, to radical politics of the 1930s, and he quickly became interested in leftist politics. He quit Fortune in 1936. And in 1937, he joined with Philip Robb and William Phillips in repositioning Partisan Review. Partisan Review, you may remember, was started as a magazine of the John Reed Club, which was an organization controlled by the Communist Party, and it was extremely doctrinal. in its early incarnation. Phillips and Robb wanted to get it out of the control of the party and to endorse aesthetic points of view that the party disapproved of, specifically avant-garde or modernist art and literature. MacDonald joined them in this effort. They rescued the magazine from the clutches of the party and relaunched it in 1937 as the Partisan Review that we all know, and MacDonald came on as an editor. When he was an editor of Partisan Review, he published an essay in 1939 about Soviet cinema, of which he was very critical. MacDonald always loved movies. In fact, later, much later in his career, he was a movie critic for Esquire magazine, and he particularly liked the Russian movies of the 1920s, which were very avant-garde experimental films. He felt that under Stalin, Soviet cinema had become a propagandistic and anti-avant-garde, and he wrote a very long piece, actually three-part piece, very critical of Soviet cinema under Stalin. This is in 1939. In response to this piece, he got a letter from Clement Greenberg. Now, Clement Greenberg then was a 28-year-old aspiring poet who was eager to write for Partisan Review, sent a letter to MacDonald, who was an editor there. MacDonald, quite a long letter, critiquing MacDonald's article. MacDonald loved to be critiqued. He loved criticism. He loved to provoke people, and he liked to be provoked. And he said to Greenberg, wrote back to Greenberg, said, "This is a great letter. Why don't you turn it into an article?" So Greenberg, with MacDonald's editorial assistance, turned it into a very famous essay called Avant-Garde and Kitsch. It was published in the fall of 1939 in Partisan Review. And this is an essay which lays out essentially the highbrow, lowbrow distinction, which Greenberg called avant-garde and kitsch, that really dominated American or New York intellectual life for the next 30 years and was a big influence on MacDonald's own writing on popular culture. MacDonald quit a Partisan Review in 1944. There was a kind of power struggle at the journal, and he lost out. He also was a pacifist and anti-war, which was not the official politics of the magazine. Greenberg also quit. He had come on as an editor in the 1940s. And MacDonald started up his own little magazine called Politics, which he edited for about 5 years. Kind of an amazing, very small journal, had less than 5,000 subscribers, but amazingly well-edited and fascinating magazine, in part because it was anti-war in the 1940s and took a pacifist point of view. MacDonald then was a pacifist and described himself as an anarchist. When MacDonald shut down Politics finally, he became a staff writer. This is in 1952, became a staff writer in 1952, shut down Politics some years before that at The New Yorker. MacDonald had written for The New Yorker since the 1920s, but he had not really been identified with the magazine. But in the late 1940s, he began working with William Shawn, who was an editor there. In 1952, Shawn became the editor-in-chief and made MacDonald a staff writer. This is where MacDonald began writing the pieces that he collects in Against the American Grain and that are reprinted in this New York Review volume. These pieces were great journalistic attacks on what MacDonald called mid-cult, or middle-brow culture. So he attacked the 54-volume Great Books of the Western World, published by the Encyclopedia Britannica and edited by Mortimer Adler, with an enormous set of introductory notes by Adler. He attacked Webster's Third International Dictionary, which was a programmatically descriptive rather than prescriptive dictionary about usage. He attacked the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, the retranslation of the King James Bible using more modern vocabulary. He attacked, though not in The New Yorker because The New Yorker had praised the book, a prize-winning novel by James Gould Cousins called By Love Possessed. That's one of his greatest pieces. And he also attacked other paragons of what he thought of as mid-cult or middle-brow culture, including Norman Cousins, the editor of the Saturday Review, and its successor, a magazine called World, also one of MacDonald's funniest pieces. In 1962, as I said, he collected a number of these pieces along with other work and a big essay supporting them, a kind of theoretical manifesto called Mass Cult and Mid-Cult, which we also reprint in the book, which outlined his theory of the development of mass culture and his argument for its perniciousness, a theory which evolved out of Clement Greenberg's old 1939 Partisan Review article, Avant-Garde and Kitsch. Later, after publishing Against the American Grain, MacDonald published several other collections, a great one called Memoirs of a Revolutionist, which collected his political writings. It has a fantastic introduction, a kind of retrospective on his career in left-wing circles in New York City, a volume called Discriminations, another collection of his pieces. 1968, fascinatingly, and to the disgust of most of the old left comrades that he had from Partisan Review days, he became enamored of the student radicals at Columbia, the protesters who occupied Low Library in Hamilton Hall and ultimately were routed by the police. And he participated in an anti-commencement ceremony that was sponsored by the radical students in 1968. It was all part of his anarchism and his siding with anybody who was against authority, very much part of his temperament. Just a couple remarks about the essays, and then Dan's going to say a few things about MacDonald, personally a writer whom I never met. One is that these essays are wonderful examples of literary journalism at its best. Where MacDonald, I think, tends to be weak, as most magazine writers and literary writer journalists tend to be weakest, is in large historical generalization and in theoretical armature. It's just not the way journalists think. Journalism is very ad hoc. It's very much about the object in front of you. It's really much more about that than about coming from a larger paradigm. It's the opposite of academic criticism in that sense. Academics tend to start with a big historical generalization or a theoretical paradigm and then use specific text to elucidate that. And journalists really work the other way around. So MacDonald is great when he's given something to chew on, and he really goes to town on it. And he has a lot of flavor in his writing, which makes these still wonderful to read. But more important than that, they really perform really the mission of magazine journalism, literary journalism, magazine criticism, which is to expose pretentiousness and vanity and self-delusion and efforts to bully readers into thinking they should like something that is really meretricious. And he's wonderful at exposing this, and that is one of the great functions, I think, of that kind of writing. I think the weakness from our perspective of this, of the work that he collects in Against the American Grain, is the whole highbrow, lowbrow paradigm. I don't think we have much use for it anymore, and it's really a relic of a period of a combination of left-wing politics and extreme attachment to modernism and art and literature that's became passé after the 1960s. Not that we still don't admire the modernist and avant-garde work, but we have a much different attitude about popular culture than MacDonald did. So now I'm pleased that Dan is here. You have a microphone?
I do.
All right, speak into it.
Well, what I'll try to do in a few minutes is give you some impression of Dwight, whom I first met in the late 40s, and we lived in Wellfleet before the great mass of sociologists, psychiatrists, architects descended on that place, but it was on the eve of that, and there was a wonderful little pond near Wellfleet Center. They had a series of ponds, and he lived in one of those, Slough Pond, a good name, I think, for the whole scene.
The Slough of Despond, I think?
Well, yes, I suppose the Slough of Despond, but there was very little despondency there and a great deal of fun. He lived in a kind of an insouciant way, indecorously. When you called on him, he might be just standing over there with the door naked as he opened the door. And of course, swimming was de rigueur without bathing suits. And then there's a kind of life on the beach, which is very close by on the ocean, and he would be there as a kind of an attendant. He played with the children, would conduct walks and celebrations with them, and became a real character. Everybody knew him. He knew the locals very well, and so it was always a great pleasure, a tonic feeling to be with him, because he was never lugubrious. He was always happy, jolly, I would say, not necessarily happy. He would, of course, have his acerbic moments. He was very, very blunt, very rude, very outspoken, but there was always, I think, what most pleasing about him, a kind of joyousness, a real pleasure he took in life, and an interest in the people who he met. He was interested, he was in no way stuck up. He had none of that, you would think of our view of New Haven at that time as compared with Cambridge, seemed to me a much more stiff and conventional place. And apparently when he was there, he fit in perfectly well with the general Yale milieu. He was served on the Yale News, and he was active in activities. But apparently, Lucas described to you his move to New York and the great change that it made in his disposition. And I think he always retained a kind of Yale quality, a sense that he was comfortable with these people that he disdained. He came from impeccable sources, so he didn't have to feel any embarrassment at all or anxieties. I've been reading just recently the journals of Alfred Kazin, and there are also some rather acerbic references in the journals to MacDonald in Alfred Kazin's journals, where Alfred was always defensive and angry, and even his humor wasn't really humorous at all. Alfred liked to talk about, well, his one of his favorite words was hilarious, but he was the most unhilarious man I've ever known. Whereas Dwight was hilarious, and when he was, no matter what he was doing, his parties his lack of, his irritation at any kind of pretentiousness, of bombast. He was very direct with everybody, every kind of a group. You never felt that he himself was considered himself an intellectual or any kind of a stiffness in his manners with ordinary people, just the people that he met every day. I had one more little reminiscence before I'll sit down. I organized a group at the Salzburg Seminar on American popular culture, and Dwight was one of the people who came to it, and it was extremely amusing. And even at that time, began a quarrel with the director of the seminar, so much to the point that there were pitched battles and very disagreeable occurrences. But his class was a source of great joy and amusement and shock to these European students who were used to professors, he was called professor, who were not given to the kinds of facetiousness and humor and indecorousness that Dwight did. And he would be describing, let's say, the American packaging, how everything that built up, was very, very difficult to even unpackage anything. Because of all the elaborate layers and so forth. And then he was searching for a metaphor or an analogy to unwrapping a package of soap or candy or something. And then he would say, well, it was just like trying to undress a woman. Now that kind of thing now seems pretty passive, but to these European students for whom professors were people of a special class and aura around them, it was a kind of a shock, but they were terribly amused at the same time, and he was a great favorite. And in any quarrels between the administration and the student body, he was always with the students. I don't think I have anything more to say about him. I can think of occasions when, well, no, I think probably the best thing to do is just sit down.
Thanks very much. So I'll talk for a few minutes and just first a little bit more about the book itself, and then in historical and a little bit more in a political mode, and then hopefully we can talk about some of the issues that you may find crystallized out of our discussion tonight. The book was published, as Luke said, in 1962. It was called Against the American Grain, Essays on the Effects of Mass Culture. There was a 70-page theoretical piece where MacDonald sort of incompletely absorbs an intellectual tradition that I'll talk about in a few minutes of mass culture criticism. There's a piece which is my favorite piece of the book on James Agee. It's the reverential heart of the book, I think. There's a piece on James Cousins. There's attacks on great books, on new editions of the Bible and the dictionary, and a nice piece of cultural criticism that stands on its own called The Triumph of the Fact. The original book had essays on Mark Twain, which we deleted, James Joyce, on Colin Wilson's 1956 novel, The Outsider, another attack of MacDonald levels on literary sensationalism, Raymond Williams's book, Culture and Society, and a couple of other essays in cultural criticism, The Decline and Fall of English, Amateur Journalism, and How-To-ism. We did add two pieces, one on Tom Wolfe and one on Norman Cousins. Norman Cousins in particular is a name that most of MacDonald's readers would have recognized at the time. In fact, most of his readers would also recognize the reference that he was making in his book, in the title, Against the American Grain. This is a reference to, of course, William Carlos Williams' book, In the American Grain, which was a series of prose poems or imaginative excursions probing the American unconscious. It was that book appeared in 1925, and those of you who know your literary history will recall that this was a particularly poignant moment in the culture, not completely unlike our own moment, where there was a lot of anxiety about the American past, a search for an American grain, a search for an American idiom. Lewis Mumford's The Golden Day appeared in 1926. Mumford championed antebellum literary culture, and then also championed the revival of Herman Melville, who was sort of rediscovered. D.H. Lawrence's studies in classic American literature appeared also this time. So MacDonald is writing in the 50s, and then he publishes in 62 on the kind of other side of a great divide in American cultural history, the ideal of Whitman-esque striving being a distant memory. So MacDonald's generation has gone through fascism and totalitarianism and corporatism. So MacDonald still had some of this taste for antebellum literary culture. His favorite writer was Poe, but the book on the whole is of course fairly pessimistic about the chances of a revival such that William Carlos Williams had been hoping for. So this raises the question of the relevance today. The commentary that we've seen so far in the book has been on the whole fairly positive, but there's this sort of quick dismissal, I think, or too quick of a dismissal, that the issues that MacDonald was grappling with, however inexpertly or in an unscholarly way, still they're still alive. There's an assumption that they don't matter as well. And one of the questions that emerges is what happened to this mid-cult, this middle-brow culture that MacDonald was skewering so well in the 50s. David Brooks says in this column in 2005, that back in the late 50s and 60s, middlebrow culture, which is really high-toned popular culture, was thriving in America. There was still a sense that culture is good for your character, and that a respectable person should spend some time absorbing the best that has been thought and said. Middlebrow culture in the late 50s was killed off from opposite directions, and one of these directions, Brooks tells us, is, of course, the big, meanie intellectuals. He says the intellectuals launched assaults on what they took to be middlebrow institutions, attacks that are so vicious they take your breath away. So this is the the theory that you know, the conservatives often bring out, that the intellectuals sort of ruin everything. And you know, I think MacDonald and Clement Greenberg and some of the others, however well they thought of themselves, would have laughed at the idea that they had such world historical power to kill off all these institutions. There must have been something, in other words, that was wrong with the institutions themselves, wrong with the middle brow ethos. It may have been quite possibly as cheap as MacDonald thought it was. Otherwise, we needed a good explanation of why it managed to disappear so quickly. We don't have highbrow culture anymore. We don't have middle brow either. We just have mass culture. So, and this, in fact, is one of the reasons I think it's important to reread the book. Even if we don't agree that MacDonald gets every issue right, we think he goes too far, which he probably does, as Luke says in his introduction on Tom Wolfe. And even if we think that he doesn't exactly get the scholarly apparatus, all the kinks worked out of it, this is just to say that as a journalist, he has difficulty finding a proper level of abstraction. He's sort of too high in the early essay, and then he's kind of too low to the ground on the Wolfe essay, and he never exactly worked it out. Nevertheless, if you read it, you'll be impressed with the moral and political implications, I think, of his critique of culture, mass culture, that is. The critique itself goes back to the 1830s and the 1840s. Thinkers like John Stuart Mill and Alexis de Tocqueville, perfectly reputable people these days, all over their writing was this worry that modern commercial society would end up corrupting the democratic potential of the forces it unleashed. This is called the critique of leveling sometimes. The idea that a society based on equality tends toward mediocrity in its consumer products. So I don't want to go on too much about this, but I would like to, well, let me just raise the question then. I hope we can talk about in a moment the relevance of this critique, if it is of any interest, if it is worth the while to try to distinguish between capitalist modes of production, which produce these cultural institutions, and the needs of a democratic society. This is, I think, at the highest level what MacDonald is worried about. He's worried about the relationship between capitalism and democracy, which is more or less a very unfashionable thing these days. They're assumed to be more or less the same. Since MacDonald died, it was 82, I think, is that when he died, 82? We've had waves in the academy, of cultural studies programs that have more or less obliterated these distinctions that MacDonald was working with. And this, I don't mean this in a pejorative sense. You know, the origins of cultural studies in the academy are very reputable indeed. They go back to mass communications research by Paul Lazarsfeld and people like that in the 50s at Stuart Hall in the Birmingham School in the 1960s. Those of you who've been to graduate school maybe recognize these names. But by the 90s, cultural studies had more or less played itself out. And the idea of the sovereign consumer, at one level, seems naturalized to a certain kind of intellectual culture, but also from my perspective, and I think it would be from MacDonald's perspective, ripe for criticism. Neuroscience, which takes the place of a former kind of social and political criticism, also sort of just obliterates the mass culture tradition. And I have in mind a book called Everything Bad is Good for You by Stephen Johnson, which appeared in 2005. You know, Johnson applies neuroscience to society and says things like video games and television and movies and mass entertainments are making us smarter, he thinks. And he mentions MacDonald as someone who wasn't a good enough scientist, who couldn't have known that The Sopranos would be many times more complex than Hill Street Blues, and that Hill Street Blues were many times more complex than Three's Company, which are examples that he gives. So between cultural studies in the academy and the, I wouldn't say the sovereignty, but the influence of neuroscience in a certain kind of intellectual journalism, the issues that MacDonald is raising here in the most abstract and the most political idiom that are represented in the book pretty much just don't exist. So we think that this book makes a very definite, if inevitably flawed and incomplete, contribution to discussions about large issues. All right, I think I'll just stop there, and maybe we can have some questions, or we can, do you want to make any more statements? Ben, you can we can sort of get a conversation going.